desire for approval. All right, I don't want to hold anything up here. We're a little late starting. It's my pleasure to introduce to you our first speaker, our keynote speaker, Bradley Kuhn. Bradley has been with the Free Software Foundation and is currently the mastermind of the Free Software Conservancy. And he's going to speak to us about the GPL. We know nothing about that, so I'm going to hand the microphone to him so that we can learn. Bradley, go.
Hopefully my screen's going to come back. I suppose. Ah, there it is. So I'm really honored to be invited to speak. Sambo was one of two charter members of the Software Freedom Conservancy, which is the organization I run now. So don't tell anybody else this, but you're one of the more important projects. But don't tell the other 26 members. I want to give you first a bit about my history and how I got involved with free software generally and ended up being the GPL enforcement guy. I didn't really intend that to happen, but it has. It all started when I was volunteering for the Free Software Foundation. I spent most of the mid-1990s emailing RMS and begging him to let me do volunteer work for the FSF, which eventually worked. And at one point in 1999, he sent me an email and said, "We had this company violate the GPL, and we have to check to make sure that the source code they gave us is actually the correct source code now that they're coming into compliance with the GPL." So that's the first time I ever got involved with doing GPL enforcement work. And I liked it so much, because I guess I'm a masochist, that I went to work for the Free Software Foundation, and I was there for 5 years as an employee, as its executive director. And then I liked doing enforcement and legal-related junk so much that I went to work for the Software Freedom Law Center for 5 years, where I did a lot of GPL enforcement as part of many other duties. And now I'm the executive director of this thing called the Software Freedom Conservancy. And as I mentioned, it is the not-for-profit home for Sambo. Many of you have received checks signed by me for your travel expenses at times. And that's sort of the more boring part of my job. I handle administrative duties so Sambo developers won't have to, and all the other developers of all our member projects won't have to. And we have a big menu of services that we offer to projects. And one of those services that we offer is GPL enforcement, because I just can't escape doing enforcement of the copyleft. And I thought back when I started, I started doing kind of an enforcement speaking tour lately, and I started thinking back on all this time I've been doing GPL enforcement, and while it hasn't been the majority of my time that I've spent on it, but when I put all the things, the different things I've worked on, the single thing that I've worked on most, so the plurality of my time in the last 11 years, has been spent doing GPL enforcement. How this happened, I'm not really sure. It was more of a comedy of errors than anything else. But I've become known as the GPL enforcement person. And so I view most of free software through the eyes of a person that enforces the GPL. And when I look out into the free software world, in that mindset, there's basically two groups of free software developers. There's the permissively licensed type. These are the Apache folks, the BSD folks, any license that doesn't have a copy left. And it's not that they don't want software to be free software. They agree with those of us in the copyleft world a lot more than you realize. They just believe that the mechanism for convincing companies and other entities to liberate code is social pressure. There's a tremendous amount of social pressure in, for example, the OpenBSD community. If you make code from OpenBSD proprietary, Theo de Rod and his minions email you until you liberate it. This happens. Sun classically got a proprietorized SSH and got emails for months and months from Theo telling them to liberate the SSH code. And I sort of call this, copyleft by guilt kind of thing, right? And so they need the liberation of code, but they don't want a license to require. And then there's those of us in the copyleft world. And our license actually requires that you liberate code and you make it free software. So I've been, and being the executive director of Conservancy now, we have some copyleft projects and we have some permissive and license projects. And they're sort of in two classes in my mind. But the fact of the matter is I've spent a lot more time in the copyleft world over the years, so my story is about the history of free software, and especially through the eyes of GPL enforcement, technically stories about the copyleft world. I want to talk a little bit about this point of requiring a license. I know I don't have to convince this community why it matters, but I actually want to make this point very clearly. Social pressure actually works. I'm not a fan of Theo's model of emailing people until they free the software, but the idea of convincing people, hey, you really should do this, it's best for the community, put the code out there, it's going to make the world a better place, it's going to make it easier for you to maintain, because we'll take over the maintenance in our community rather than you doing all the work internally. That works a lot of the time. In fact, even if you're a copylefted project, that should be your first order of business if somebody's not giving back the code, because that can just work and get it all solved. So why not take that as your first step? I generally see GPL enforcement as a last resort when the social pressure thing doesn't work. The times when you have to go to the requirements of the license and start quoting sections of the GPL with someone, that should be the last thing you have to do after you've tried everything else to convince them to do the right thing. It's sort of like a, and I apologize a little US bias here, but I see the GPL as very akin to the US Constitution. It lays out a framework for how freedoms should be available. Now, living in the US, I know full well that we don't frequently live up to our Constitution, but in the end, it's a written down embodiment of the ideals that our community is supposed to believe in. And I think GPL does a better job of this than the US Constitution, because I think the GPL is an embodiment of the ideals of software freedom. It's basically just an implementation. If you think of free software as an algorithm, for software freedom is just this algorithm of what people should have with regard to rights of software, GPL is an implementation, a working, running implementation of those ideals. It guarantees the four freedoms of free software: the freedom to study the code, the freedom to run it for any purpose, the freedom to make it better so you can fix bugs for yourself, the freedom to share it with other people, both as a business, commercially, selling it to people, or just to giving a copy to your friend, and the freedom, once you've made some improvements, to give those back to the community or put yourself in business improving software, which I know a lot of you do for some. You're paid to make improvements to software. These are the freedoms that you know full well the GPL guarantees. Now, most of you in the crowd know this, so the question is this talk really for you? Well, it's not exactly for you, except for the fact that I stayed up all night rewriting it to make very clear it was for you. So I wrote it for you, so it's for you. But the key thing is it's not about people in this room. Because the thing is, this room is filled with two types of people, basically. We have the Samba developers who actually work on the code, and we have very sophisticated Samba users. And those two classes of people, I don't find them in violation of GPL. And if I do, they fix it within a matter of days, if not hours. So I'm not really talking about the companies that are in this room most of the time, because you already know enough about the software that you paid attention to what its license is. There are people out there who have not. And that's really who this talk is about. Now, I want to talk, now that I've made that point, I want to talk about the issue of theory versus practice. So I originally started as a theoretical computer scientist. I have a master's degree and dropped out of the PhD program. And one of the reasons I quit doing academic computer science is there is this disconnect in the academic computer science world between the theory of computer science and actually writing code. And I think the GPL sometimes has this problem as well. So let me present the theory of GPL first. And then I'll talk about the practice of GPL. So GPL is centered around this idea of copyright, which is the legal framework, which is more or less internationalized, of how authors can control, and it is control, of what happens to the works they create. And it's true that there's substantial differences in copyright law when you compare the European system, for example, to the US system. But in the end, through Berne Convention, copyright pretty much works across the industrialized world the same way. So the idea of GPL, quite simply, is to take copyright law and hack it. Use it instead of what it's normally used for, to take away people's rights, and instead give them all the permissions, those freedoms to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software. But, as you know, it makes those permissions conditional on making sure everyone else has the same stuff. And this is the hack that you all have heard about before, of how copyright law is hacked with copyleft. Now, the complicated thing about this, and this is where it gets into the weirdness of the practice of GPL, is the only way you can make sure that people do what the GPL says and respect each other's freedom is to use the copyright system. So in reality, what do you do when someone doesn't share and share alike, when someone doesn't respect people's freedom to copy, share, and modify the software? Well, as I mentioned, you should try the social pressure thing. You should try, hey, do the right thing, it's good for the world, etc. But if that doesn't work, well, you're left with doing enforcement of copyrights. And believe me, having done GPL enforcement this long, I am fully aware that you could say I do something very similar to what the MPAA does. Now, I'm opposed to criminal copyright infringement. I don't believe copyright infringement should ever be criminal. That's where I truly disagree with the MPAA. It's a civil matter. It's a dispute between two people. The police shouldn't show up if you infringe copyright. You should get a nasty letter from the copyright holder, which is what I do. But there is some irony to this, right? And I get that. I believe in my heart that I'm doing it for a good cause. I believe that I'm using the tools of the oppressor against the oppressor. I believe that's what I'm doing. But there's some irony there that I acknowledge. And this is where the theory and the reality differ, right? It's kind of nasty to be a copyright enforcer. I used to work at the FSF with a guy named David Turner, whose name's Novalis. And he was one of the best GPL enforcers I ever worked with. He doesn't do it anymore. I asked him why he doesn't do it anymore. He says, enforcing the GPL makes me think like a cop. I don't want to think like a cop anymore. And so I get that. You know, I get the irony of doing enforcement, but in the end, I believe it's for a good self cause. I want to talk just very briefly about some history of GPL enforcement, because I think it'll inform the stuff I want to say towards the later part of the talk. So if you go back in time to the mid-80s, the very first GPL program was GNU/Linux. In fact, GNU/Linux is such an ancient program that it was licensed under a different license first. It was licensed under something called the Emacs Public License, which was a proto-GPL that RMS wrote. And a lot of people don't know this. So first of all, there's lots of confusion about what the G stands for. First of all, I know nobody in this room made that mistake, but first people think it stands for GNU. In fact, it does, and it stands for General Public License. But the general, in General Public License, which I always thought meant a license for the general public, actually doesn't mean that. RMS told me he called it the General Public License because it was a generalized version of the Emacs Public License. That he had said, well, the Emacs Public License was specific to Emacs, and I made it for the program, whatever, and I made it a variable. So it was the generalized public license. Now, I think it's cooler if you talk about it as a license for the general public. It's a license for everyone. But in fact, that's retroactive. It's rewriting history. Because in fact, it was just the generalized version of the Emacs public license. Now, the funny thing about Emacs is that nobody ever violates the GPL. And I think that's a community thing. Most people who use Emacs, I guess I should take a poll. Emacs users, hands up. Ooh, them? Eek, what a scared room. I almost put the cartoon with the guy hiding and said, why are the police chasing us, Daddy? It's because we use GimpSun, not Emacs. I guess I shouldn't put that on. I thought some of the developers were an Emacs crowd. I'm flustered. It's scary. But it turns out the community of Emacs users are not the kind of people that would try to make proprietary modifications or otherwise just fail to comply with the GPL. It just doesn't happen that often. So by the time we actually get a GPL violation, we had moved on to the second program that was licensed under GPL, which was the GNU Compiler Collection, although in those days it was called the GNU C Compiler. Now, this is something, a compiler, that companies would like to pick up and do something with and boy, they really don't want to liberate their code. Does anybody know who, and this is my own research, I've talked to RMS a lot about this, so I believe it's correct. Anybody want to guess who, as far as we know, was the first entity to ever violate the GPL? Or first person, either one? Anybody want to think of a guy named Jeremy knows because I showed him these slides already? No one wants to guess? So this guy was the first GPL violator, as it turns out. So in the late 80s, Steve Jobs was running Next, and he decided to create this new language called Objective-C. And of course, he needed a compiler, and he said, well, if I need a compiler, I can take this GCC thing, I'll make an Objective-C front end, and I'll just release the object code. And if somebody wants the Objective-C compiler, they can just link the upstream GCC with my object code for the front end, and they'll have an Objective-C compiler, I don't have to release the code. And so this was the first GPL enforcement that ever happened. Now, it's like most GPL enforcement, it's not publicly documented on the net. It was done privately. The only documentation I can find, because it's discussed heavily in Usenet throughout the late 80s and early 90s, this is the earliest Usenet post about it that I can find, which is in September of 1989. And this is late in the process, because this person's already had a copy of a book about the Next operating system, which says that it is based on GCC, and obviously the violation must have already been resolved by the time the guy posted this, because he's responded to within days by somebody from Next saying, oh yeah, it's going to be in the Next upstream GCC, it's going to be released soon, and so forth. So I went to do research on this violation, and I talked to RMS about it, and I asked him that, and I said, so how did it all go? Because he's written about it. If you read it, it's rather a seminal essay that he wrote in the early 90s called Copyleft Pragmatic Idealism. He talks about this violation and how the copyleft works and why it's good and so forth. And I asked him, I said, well, what are the details? Because I have like two sentences in this essay about it. What are the details of the violation? Very briefly, he says, oh, I can't possibly remember that. And I said, well, Richard, do you know? Did you talk to Steve Jobs on the phone or something? He goes, I might have talked to Steve. I can't remember if I talked to Steve Jobs. Now, when he said that, I realized that I'm really glad that we have a movement led by a guy who wouldn't bother to remember if he never talked to Steve Jobs. That's a good thing. If I ever talked to Steve Jobs on the phone, I'd remember. Forever. Right? But Richard doesn't remember. Maybe not. Who knows? So this is what began. This violation creates a cascade of events for Steve Jobs and ultimately Apple when he returns to Apple. Now, you all know in this room that quite to your chagrin and everybody else's, that they took Samba, but I hope you won't take it personally. Because Jobs decided, in my view, and I've talked to the guy at that point out, so I don't know for sure, but my guess is he made a decision at Next after that Objective-C thing happened. He said, I'm never going to rely on GPL software. Yeah, and he probably had to modify that for various things to make OS X work. But from that moment when he said he had to use a GPL program, he decided, I'm going to either buy every GPL program that I need, that's what happened with Cups, or I'm going to replace it. So this is the fate of Apple using Samba was sort of sealed before the Samba project even began. Because in 1989, I think Steve Jobs made a decision, I'm going to avoid this GPL stuff as much as I can. And the same thing's happening with GCC. Apple relies heavily on GCC right now, but they are dumping tons of money and resources and advocacy into LLVM because they want a BSD compiler infrastructure that they can make proprietary modifications to when they want to. And they actually hire GCC developers who work on GCC for a while and switch them to working on LLVM. So Apple, a lot of times people talk about, well, the GPL is bad because people don't adopt, but in my view, Jobs made a decision, Apple made a decision, it doesn't want software freedom, and it has to work to get rid of stuff that ensures software freedom, like GPL. And in fact, during the GPL-V3 process, Apple spread a tremendous amount of FUD about GPL and so forth, and they continue to do so, and they're continuing to say GPL-V3 is somehow dangerous, and somehow companies can't use it, and there's companies in this room that are shipping Samba under GPL-V3 and have no problems. We all know that that's just not true. But Apple has a plan to get rid of, at least from its life, GPL software. And this is actually sort of a pattern of what's happened in the free software commercial ecosystem. It's now the case that GPL is not a surprise to anyone. Everybody in the software industry who's savvy has heard of it. And those who understand have made a conscious choice. They've decided, okay, I'm either going to adopt this stuff, and then I'm going to comply with the license, I'm going to do what it says, or I'm just going to avoid it entirely. And Apple is obviously going to the latter, and other companies have done the former. But that's it's a complete bifurcation in at least the savvy people in the industry. And then ultimately, that's again why I said it's a lot different now. You know, I mean, you take, for example, Chris Devone at Google, who's very fond of saying, if there's ever a GPL violation that Google's committed, I'll resolve it within 24 hours. And he's done that more than once. He's been told about a GPL violation and got it resolved within 24 hours. And those of us that enforce the GPL, we know that we're human beings, nobody's perfect. There will be infractions of the license. And the real important thing is they get resolved quickly. And the savvy companies and the companies that are aware of GPL that have adopted GPL software generally come into compliance quickly. But obviously, that's not the whole story. There's somebody else that I'm talking about here. And what we have today is Conservancy started doing GPL enforcement in 2007, sort of officially, for the BusyBox project. And we opened up an email address, which was gpl@busybox.net, and said to the world, email us if you know about a GPL violation. And within a couple of weeks, we had more than 100 GPL violations queued for actual. Today, my list is more than 300 GPL violations that I'm actively aware of. I can't possibly chase them all, so I have a lot of them queued, and I try to triage as best I can. But the nature of all of them is pretty much the same. They're almost all unembedded products. They are almost all products that are made very cheaply, and not a lot of thought is put into the software build and how good it is and what it does. And very rarely do they add new code. So when you look at something like the Objective-C violation and say, well, that was actually a new front end, it's still supported in GCC today. And it was new code that was written that was of interest, at least if you want to program in Objective-C, I don't want to. I'm not making iPhone apps anytime soon. But there are people that want to write Objective-C, and they have this new feature in GCC. But the GPL violations today are not somebody adding a new feature. If you look at most of the violations out there today, it's mostly the upstream program, maybe with a few patches backported, or if it has any patches, there are probably patches available from the net somewhere sitting in a bug tracker. It's not like they're writing a lot of new code. And the only thing they've done is innovative, which I put it in quotes because they don't do it that well, is they have an infrastructure to build the thing and make a firmware that goes onto the device. And that's the only interesting part. The fact is, the GPL violator of today is the unsophisticated company. In fact, it's the competitors of your companies. Because you guys are all sophisticated Samba users and integrators and that sort of thing, and you do smart things with Samba and the entire embedded stack. Love it. Your competitors are more or less free riding on that. They're just taking the stuff and throwing it into a device and selling it for half the price and violating GPL in the process. And that's why I care. That's one of the reasons why I care. Because the folks in this room who comply with the GPL, you're being undercut by those 300 plus companies that I'm sitting with, many of which have Samba violations. It's not fair to you. You guys have done the right thing. You've complied. There's no reason they should get away with a GPL violation just because I haven't gotten to them yet. I wish I could get more, and I'm trying, but it's not fair to those. And it's not fair to the end users, because they buy these devices, and the average end user, particularly on the consumer market, doesn't really know the difference between one mass device to the next. They just buy one, and they put it in their, they want to put all the movies on it, they put it in their apartment or their house, and they start putting stuff on it over the SMB connection. And of course, the software build's not that good. Maybe it has an ancient version of Samba, maybe it's just not configured right, all sorts of things like that. You're talking about the Slash Cycles. And the community sees this and wants to make that firmware better. They're like, oh, the hardware, maybe the hardware's not so bad. It's okay, hardware. Let's make a firmware for it that actually works right. But they can't. Because even if they're just using mostly upstream everything with a few patches, they can't build it. And the users of these devices are left helpless basically in the same way that RMS always says proprietary software leaves users helpless. It's the same problem. It's a proprietarization problem, even though it's not really proprietary modifications. Because GPL isn't just there to stop the Objective-C like situations. It's there to defend every software freedom people get, which includes the freedom to modify the software. And then we have to ask the question, on an embedded device, what does it mean to modify the software? Well, okay, I've got the sources. In fact, when I do an enforcement matter, the first thing they do is say, oh, you want the BusyBox sources, you can get that from BusyBox.net. And I say, I am BusyBox.net. I have those sources. But the thing I want to know is, can I build BusyBox and everything else, all the other GPL stuff, in the same way, the way your company did? And if I get that thing built, will I be able to install it onto that piece of hardware that you gave me, or something? And if by chance, I get the build and the install working, by the time that happens, by the time you come into compliance, will it be so late that the product's been discontinued? And will your next product line actually violate the GPL and I have to play the same game with you again? These are the questions of compliance in the embedded software space. It's not really, did they make some great new improvement to Samba or BusyBox? Because frankly, free software got so good that you guys can make all the best improvements anyway on Samba. The BusyBox guys can make all the best improvements in BusyBox. Most companies, at least small ones or ones that are not really savvy to the software industry, particularly free software, they're not going to do that much to actually change it, but they are going to get it built and installed on their hardware. And that's the question of software freedom. That's the question of enforcement in the embedded age. Now, the neat thing is that RMS is a genius, basically, and that's the fact that I hope no one will dispute that. And he looked ahead when he wrote GPL version 2. And in fact, GPL version 2 has something in it to handle this. And I know that I don't have to read it off the slide, because I know this, I say it to people on the phone all the time, because remember, BusyBox is V2 only, so I'm doing a lot of V2 enforcement. You have to include with the source code. In fact, it's part of the source code by definition in GPL V2. The scripts used to control compilation and installation of the executable. And my reading of that is that this gets us to really pretty close to what you're supposed to have with regard to an embedded device. And I think it handles most of the issues. I've actually argued, not successfully, unfortunately, that scripts really includes the idea of any kind of authorization key to install into the hardware. I believe that's part of the scripts to control installation. RMS gave in on that one and has said publicly that the scripts to control compilation and installation do not include authorization keys. So I wasn't happy that we gave in on that one, but fortunately we have a new version of the license. It was a little bit buggy. The code was a little bit too terse. It was hard to read and interpret. So we now have this much better definition of installation information. And people tend to focus on this part, and they look at authorization keys, and that's the big thing. Oh my gosh, that's what GPL V3 changed. Well, more importantly, it clarified this issue of scripts to control compilation and installation. It includes methods and procedures and other information. Basically, anything I need to know to take that thing from source code to a binary that will install on the device. That's what GPL V3 requires. And in my view, it's just clarifying the wording that's already there, but even if people don't agree with me, and most people don't, that authorization keys are not required under V2, this all makes it clear and certain. And it assures, when something's under V3, that users can modify their own device, that users can build the software and install it, and get new versions from upstream or get their own changes on there. And this is why projects should upgrade. It's clear, this is the biggest issue in my view of why V3 upgrade is needed. A lot of people talk about the patent provisions and they are very important. But for me, again, I look from the eyes of a GPL enforcer, this issue is the biggest issue in GPL enforcement. And you guys were the trailblazers. You're basically, other than FSF itself, you were the first adopters of GPL V3. And it's unfortunate that more projects haven't adopted. It's very unfortunate that BusyBox Project, which is also a member of Conservancy, I'm not going to disparage them, made the decision to go GPLB to only, because they aligned themselves with the kernel developers who wanted GPLB to only. But none of that's your fault. You guys did the right thing. It's just the rest of the non-native projects that are doing the right thing. And what it means, I think Samba ends up with a responsibility. Samba is an important piece of this embedded stack, particularly for things like NAS devices. But generally, your wireless routers have Samba on them sometimes now, because like a file, it's showing up everywhere. The video devices, I see plenty of video, like these little boxes you can put movies on. Well, how do you get movies on there? Well, it runs Samba, of course. And in these devices, particularly ones that are crypto lockdown, Samba is going to be the program because it's the only GPL program in the embedded, the GPLv3 program in the embedded stack right now. And enforcement is ultimately about the whole stack. It's about making sure you can build that whole firmware, not just one program. And I just believe that users should have this right. And so it may be Samba who has to step forward and say, we want users of all these devices to have that right, and we want to make sure enforcement happens. Now, it's not easy, this enforcement that we're doing now, because in some sense, enforcing against Next was relatively straightforward. Jobs knew he was trying to get away with something. It was just a lark in some sense. He was like, oh, well, let's see if I can make this thing proprietary. Maybe Snob won't call me, maybe he won't. Snob doesn't even remember if he called me. But in the end, we got him into compliance. But he was sort of the evil genius he has this plan to try and get away with it. The thing is most violators I deal with are kind of clueless, and I won't play this script out for you, but this is a classic conversation we have with GPL violators. They're not even aware. A lot of times, sometimes they're big companies, sometimes they're very large companies, in fact, but they're traditionally hardware vendors, and they don't have the sense that if I get a board from someone, it actually has software on it. And if I seem a little crazy, I actually invented an illness, which I call GPL enforcement fatigue. So I have this conversation a lot, and it drives me a little insane. So if I seem weird, that's probably why. And the reason this happens is, it turns out that a TV show actually said the same thing, that same conversation. This idea that, well, I just got it from somebody. I think in Taipei there must be giant office buildings filled with little tiny companies that put together little boards, OEM boards with a little system on a chip firmware for them, and companies throughout Europe and the United States acquire these boards and say, oh, we need a board for our new video thing, we need a board for our new wireless router, we need a board for our new TV. Boxes and TVs. I'm sure Samba will be in TV soon. They wire these boards, they shove them in the device, they get the pinouts and stuff to hook them up to their other parts of the hardware, and they don't even realize that this is a software product. They have no clue. They're buying from an OEM a board, and the board happens to have a firmware on it, and they never even realize the software. They don't even realize the software when the vendor gives them a firmware update. It doesn't even connect that there might be other people's software, might be our software developed by free software developers. So this kind of enforcement sort of becomes, I'm introducing these companies to their developers that they didn't know they had. Hey, the free software community, those are your developers. You should meet them. They have a license. They wanted you to do certain things. They wanted you to give the user source code and tell them they could get source code and make sure they could install it. I'd like to introduce you to those developers. And I have to convince these companies that they should not just try to get away with it. It's very tough. I'm public about the fact that I have 300 violations. The ones that have become a little bit savvy, like the Broadcoms of the world, they gamble. They wait for me to find them. Because I'm finding them downstream, and they're two layers upstream from where I'm enforcing, and they just say, well, come get us. The less savvy ones just sort of don't even pay attention. They never even heard of GPL. Sometimes they never heard of Linux. They don't know. They just buy boards that happen to have Linux and Visinox and stuff on. So right now, the Conservancy is doing enforcement. The current projects that have us doing enforcement by their request are Visibox and UCLibC. Even just with those two projects that I'm doing enforcement for, I get the report at least once a week. But often some is in there as well. And one of the things we do when we ask for compliance is we require compliance on everything, not just the program enforcement. So when I go in as a BusyBox enforcement matter, I say, okay, you violated our BusyBox, which means you can't distribute BusyBox anymore until you get your rights reinstated. GPLv2 has this thing called Section 4. Jeremy likes to call it the GPL death penalty. Basically, it says as soon as you violate the GPL, you can't distribute that software anymore until the copyright holder affirmatively tells you you can. So as part of that requirement, we say, well, before we're going to restore your rights, we're going to require that you comply with anything that's GPL or LGPL across the whole platform. So I actually get a lot of compliance on Samba by proxy, because I'm enforcing a BusyBox, and I say, well, we're not going to restore your rights on BusyBox until Samba comes into compliance. So it's there's something going on, but it's like I said, by proxy. Now, I have to leave a slide into it, because people know that these are people. And this is, again, I see the irony. It's at least I'm not suing individuals like the MPAA, because I only sue big companies. And this is really the last resort, right? So I talked about how social pressure is first. And if that doesn't work, enforcement is the last resort. Well, the last resort in that last resort is filing a lawsuit. Lawsuits take a lot of time, and it's sort of like working on a PhD in the sense you work harder and harder on less and less compliance. Because you focus on this one little product and you're just trying to get back in compliance, and once things get into a lawsuit, everybody tries to block you and it goes on forever. We've been in litigation with Best Buy for a year and 4 months now, and it's still going, and they're still not, their DVD player is still violating the GPL. So I'd rather not file lawsuits if I can avoid it. And the goal really is to settle the lawsuit, because what we really want is the users to have the freedom to build the software and install it and improve it. And that's compliance with the license, and we need it on all the GPL and LGPL programs, not just the one we're actually enforcing on. And the weird thing about judges, especially in the US, I don't do, Howard Velta does most of the enforcement in Europe, I don't do a lot of enforcement in Europe, but I'm doing a little in France now. But mostly I'm doing it in the US. And in the US, the way copyright judges think is they say, well, we want to settle and we want to get compliance, but judges just want to give you money and an injunction. They don't want to look at your license, other than to determine that there was breach. Once they say, okay, they failed to comply with your license, that's your license, that's a fact. Once that fact is established, they don't want to see the license anymore. Basically, the judges are only interested with GPLv2 Section 4, right? They're like, oh, their rights terminated the license, throw the license away. Now what am I going to give you? Well, I will make them stop distributing, which means you can shut down their product. But I don't really want that. I want their product to exist. I want them to use free software. I want that product on the market just in compliance with GPL. And then the judge wants to give you money. Well, money is helpful. It allows us to do more enforcement. But my goal is not to go around getting money and injunctions. My goal is to get compliance. So I don't actually want to take a lawsuit all the way to the end, because I know at the end, even if we win, we're not going to get what we really want, which is freedom for users. We're going to get some money, and we're going to get an injunction, which is, and the injunction is sort of the opposite of what we want. It's just a consolation prize. So as it turns out, GPL violations are truly everywhere. I see them all the time. I sat there last night working on this talk, saying, I guess everybody has one of these in their little D-Link router. And, you know, I almost downloaded the firmware to check. You know, I hadn't finished the talk, but I was like, I bet you, D-Link's going to be out of compliance, you know, it probably doesn't. So this is constant vigilance. I see a product, and I think, I look at this projector, and I say, is that a firmware or not? Well, probably not. It's probably okay. You know, it's everywhere. And I'll take a bet with anyone. You don't want to take this bet with me. Trust me, you'll lose. But in an hour, I can find a violation I've never seen. It's really easy. In fact, if you open a web browser and search the internet for the word firmware, you'll find that it's probably one I've seen before, but the first hit will be one if you search for firmware. And that's probably one I already know about. But I usually have to go 6 or 7 pages deep in the search, and eventually I find a firmware person just by searching for the word firmware. So that's about all I have to say about enforcement. And I left plenty of time at the end here. I want to take all your questions. Hear all about what you want to complain to me about GPL enforcement, what you want to know about it, or anything else about GPL. I'm a licensing geek, so So this is your chance to ask everything you ever wanted to know about GPL but were previously afraid to ask. Oh, God, somebody must want me to be counting myself. I got 15 minutes for questions. I left plenty of time. Yeah, we're back there. That's rich. Great.
Brendan, I was interested in your comment that Samsung Energy will be free in the sort of embedded stack.
I think that's not true.
It could well be. I hadn't actually thought of that before. I hadn't realised that. And I'm curious, who do you think the next one will be? I mean, GPL v3 adoption is climbing fairly steadily. So do you foresee any others in the embedded stack, typical embedded stack?
So here's the weird thing. It's going to be above, not below, right? So what happened is, because of the position the Linux developers took, that trickled up a little bit. So it trickled up basically to BusyBox developers. And not actually, the BusyBox developer I work with who's not involved as much with the project is Eric Anderson. He really wanted BusyBox to save me to a layer. But being a good former maintainer, he said, well, I'm not the maintainer anymore. I'm not working with BusyBox. Rob Langley is the maintainer now. He wants to go to GPLv2 only if he can. And Rob Langley is connected to the Linux community, so he felt he wanted to do that. So it sort of pushed up from Linux this v2 onlyness, which was really sad to see. I mean, I was in a weird position because it's what Rob wanted, and Rob's the leader of a member project for Conservancy. I told him my views, he disagreed with me, and changed the license. There's also this issue, so if you look at the LGPL side, there's this issue of GPLv2, LGPLv3 incompatibility. So that's a weird thing that I'm trying to solve as well, and a lot of projects are trying to say LGPLv2.1 or later to keep the GPLv2 only compatibility, right? So if you think about uses, take UC Libc, which is often in the embedded stack. Well, BusyBox needs to only, so you need something that can combine with UC Libc and make it work with slicable. Now, I push the idea that the LGPL side should, instead of being LGPL 2.1 or later, should switch and be LGPLv3 or later, or GPLv2 only. Now, the neat thing about this is it gives you v2 compatibility, but only with pure v2. If you want the lesser effects, you have to go to v3. That's probably the place where we might get some v3 nets. Now, Rob Langley is currently the maintainer of UC Libc, which means I'm never going to convince him to do that on UC Libc, so it won't be UC Libc either, for that matter. I think it'll be something like Samba. I don't know what it is, but something that people say, hey, if I had this on my little tiny device, this application, and the application in the kernel people, user land stuff, as kernel people would say, it's going to be something like that. It's going to be some service, and I have no idea what it is yet. It's probably not even written yet. It's that eventually the embedders are going to say, hey, if we put this on our thing, it'll be great. Because everything else in the embedded stack has already just sort of aligned itself with Linux or its permissive devices. I mean, there's libfree type shows up tons of times because they need it for on-screen display stuff. Of course, that's dual licensed LGPL BSD. So they just take the BSD path, and then there's no libfreeness to come. So I think it's not written yet. Whatever it is, it's not written yet. That's my guess, unfortunately. You guys are it. You guys are I have a slide. You guys are the trailblazers on V3. No question about it. That's true. Because the truth is Jeremy. At least the harm is not on the way.
So, I've already talked to the kernel developers, and my position to that has been V2 only is kind of antisocial, and I can't see any reason why they would go V2 plus. Because that's no. That doesn't actually damage what they do, because if they say stay V2+, it means that people embedded devices can still use the V2 if they require. It just loosens up compatibility aspects. So it's a lot easier to combine the V3 with all the code. Do you think that change is likely, or do you think that's?
I think I mean it's a reasonable start for an advocacy position. The problem is, Ted Cho has played this out. I've had this conversation with him plenty of times. And he says, well, he wants to do that so you can start sneaking V3 and stuff into the kernel and force it to be V3. Which is not true, but that's what he's going to worry about. Basically, he doesn't want the kernel, and none of the kernel developers want it to drift to V3 or later. They want to have that V2-ness sustained indefinitely. That's their current position. Now, when you explore this with kernel developers, and I have with many of them, I've talked to Greg Cage a great deal about this, I've talked to Greg a great deal about this, And they said, okay, well, you know what our real problem with V3 is. We authorization keys. I mean, those two words, that's what bugs them. They're not even that upset about the rest of the installation information. They're upset about those words in that license in that and so it, what I think the answer for the kernel is to write a GPL V3 exception. I had a whole talk on how great exceptions work in V3. It's actually really neat. The LGPL V3, by the way, is not a license onto itself. It is a list of exceptions to GPL V3, which is really kind of neat. I think there's an exception we could write that would say, take out the authorization keys part. And they could be V3 or later with the Linux kernel exception. That's probably the path to the future. Now, the challenge then, and Ted's basically agreed with me on principle. He's like, yeah, we can do that. As long as, and I said, I would, as a deal, I would go to the community and advocate, if they're giving to the kernel, put the exception on the kernel. Just when you're giving to the kernel, be willing, and everybody who's V3, without an exception, ought to be willing as a matter of collaboration to, when they're putting code in the kernel, add the exception, because it's not that big of a change. The problem is that Ted says, okay, great, that sounds fine, but it's not so great for us that we want to do the work of contacting all the copyright holders, which can be done. And the ones you can't reach, there's various estoppel things you can do. You can post a big notice saying, we are going to V3, you must object by 8, 6 months from now, and if you don't, we're moving your code to V3. Could be done, but it's a lot of work, and we have to get the code developers who want V3 enough, with the exception, to actually go there. And that's the big challenge, is they have to want it enough. It's not just to be okay with it. They have to want it because it's so much work for them to actually switch. And I think the only way to get to that is some really bad happening. We're going to have some horrible happening that convinces the Linux developers they need the backup version from V3. It's the only way they're ever going to switch. They're not going to switch for any other reason because they just don't care enough about what V3 offers.
Now, Bradley, you know I would not ask you a tricky question. But once upon a time, a man bought something, and it was his to do with as he wished. Those days are changing.
I agree.
And in fact, the day is coming when small mobile devices will not be sold, but will be licensed only. How does that impact the GPL?
Well, I mean, I think that's what GPL is trying to get rid of. It's trying to make sure that doesn't happen. Because of basically the deception, right? It makes sure, there's more to this than I put on the slide, that makes sure that you can upgrade that user product device. Make sure that if there's V3 stuff in that mobile device, you have a right to do it, and you're violating the GPL if you don't.
But you don't own it, you've only licensed the device.
The thing is that this isn't anything about copyright. Because even if you just license the device, you've received distribution of the software on the device. So the only thing that is needed for copyright to kick in, and therefore GPL, is receipt of distribution of the device. Even if you've only licensed the device, you may not own the device, but the thing is the software is distributed to you. Therefore, you can use the GPL to defend it. Always gotta come back, I'm gonna come back to that.
But the license does not authorize you to modify something that you've only licensed.
That's not true. The copyright is a totally separate system to the EULA you might have for that thing, and it can be in conflict, right? Now, they're just going to not use GPL-V3 stuff. That's the scary part, is that the Android system is based around a V2 only kernel and a bunch of attachments. That's the bigger worry. If there were V3 stuff in there, I'd be less worried. I think it's okay. But let's go. Let's let Simon ask this question. Oh, come on. Okay, that's fine.
What you said about the LGPL V3 combined with GPL2, is it documented somewhere publicly?
It is, although it's hard to follow. There's a compatibility matrix on the FSF website, and it's this big giant thing that shows which licenses are compatible with each other. And a lot of people do miss this point, but it's
The recommendation you just made.
Well, the recommendation, yes. Unfortunately, all the places documented is a post I made to the GNOME developers list, because the GNOME developers are ran into this problem. Actually, for you, what I'll do is I'll actually make that post I made a blog post on my website, so that it'll be there. But yeah, that's the only place I've ever written it up. And I'll grab that. I have the URL, and I'll grab it and put it in my blog. So watch my blog over the next week, and it'll show up.
I asked it because I suggested it to a developer, and he said it was stupid idea because FSF says use LGPL with the only.
Yeah, so RMS wants people to use LGPL v3 only, or LGPL v3 later to be exact. But the thing is you'll notice glibc is still 2.1. And glibc is still 2.1 because of this problem. As a note to it, this is just me whining, but, or whinging if you're from the UK. I wrote a memo to everybody involved with V3, Evan Bowman, Richard Stallman, Richard Fontana, like two other people, about 2 months before GPL V3 was released. The subject line of the email was, huge problem, LGPL V3 incompatible with GPL V2 only. And I wrote four paragraphs and explained, this is a huge problem, we've got to solve this before we release the license. And everybody ignored my email. And it drives me nuts. I noticed this problem before the license was released, and nobody would listen to me. Nobody cared. And so there's too much going on, basically. I think this solution is the right one. I have debates with RMS about this. He's coming around to it. I think it's going to be the only license for glibc in the end. Oric is not going to change, let the license of glibc be changed unless he approves of it. I think this is the only one we can meet with him. Oh, 10 minutes. We have 10 more minutes for questions. So ask more. But I can't promise you that the developer will leave me either, right? Because RMS has said what you basically said. And I'm trying to convince RMS. He takes time to convince Richard. It's not a trivial matter.
So not the other RMS, what is the problem with that means so we should have done so
you mean the orange thing that was
something you can see who's against the
Well, people, so in the default case, for example, with BusyBox, I think folks wish that it could be true that the installation information stuff would kick in, which of course it wouldn't. Now, the upside is it's all copylefted, but the thing is, if you're combining it with a copyleft program anyway, it's not like you're getting anything that way. The only thing it solves is it would make sure that anybody who wanted to do crypto lockdown at least has to use GPL2 for any applications they write, right? So if they take glibc and they usually in some user space program that does their video player, I don't know, CLC, that's beyond me, but they make their own little video thing or whatever, that would have to be GPL2. Of course, then they could still put their lockdown the device. And I think that's the thing that people are worried about, at least the people like RMS and so forth. I sort of compromised on that because I'm like, well, the upside is at least it forces them to free their application. And I think people want to keep applications proprietary so much that they might err towards just allowing installation information. But that's the real debate, is do we give up on the installation information part of LV3 for the sake of compatibility with V2 only? And also, there was a belief that V3 was going to be widely adopted quickly, and that didn't happen. I mean, I don't know why we believe that. I drank Kool-Aid. I believed it too. But the idea was LGPL-V3 would be a pressure point. It would sort of pressure V2-only projects to switch. And so that's why I think my memo was ignored. Because I think RMS felt, yes, we want LGPL-V3 to be incompatible because it'll pressure people to upgrade to GPL-V3. In the end, that didn't happen, so I think we sort of have to step back and be like, well, what's the compromise solution that we have to make given that adoption has happened? It's linear. I mean, if you look at graphs of GPL-V3 adoption, it's a straight line going up. But it's going to take time for projects to switch. And in the meantime, we probably need a solution. So that's where I think I sort of explained where the tension points are. Chris?
So given all these different tension points and balances and such, what's the best resource to go to when you're trying to figure out what license you want to apply to it and you want to create it?
So what you want to look at is a document called the GPL version 3, and use that. I think that's a good answer. I mean, the serious answer is, I think it's companies have to figure out what they want to do, right? I mean, if it's a personal project, I don't see why you wouldn't put it on GPL 3. If it's a company trying to decide, well, they have all sorts of balances that they want to make. So I think it's a tough decision. And obviously, if you're working for a company, you have lawyers, and you ask the lawyers to read the licenses, see what they make you use, in some sense, because you're going to have to clear it through that anyway. But I think GPL3 is a really good license. I think it solves a lot of problems. I think it's good for companies, too. And so I think basically, when you're answering that question, you should say, why are we not using GPL3? And you should have a reason, a good reason that says, we're not using GPL3 because of this specific text in GPL3 that we don't like, and this other license doesn't have that text. That's how I would respond. But I'm a biased copyright guy, right? So I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. More stuff out there.
So just to continue in discussion is, if I'm about to create my company or something like that, you mean that I should choose the GPL3 for every product that I will release?
I hope so. I mean,
because you say, well, if you are already your company and we have concern, you have to check with them. But if you are not low savvy, you could trust GPL3. You just sufficient for your company.
I think so. I mean, again, I'm biased, right? I mean, you're asking a guy who helped design on the GPL this question. I think if you're a web services company, the Affero GPL is a good option. That's sort of the license I'm most associated with. I invented this Affero clause thing. I think companies are better off with copyleft because it assures that if you're going to release it at all, right? I mean, obviously you can keep it private and you can prioritize it, but I assume you're thinking about releasing this free software if you're even asking this question. And the strongest copyleft you can get is most likely to defend your company from somebody bigger coming along, taking your code, and going into competition with you. They can do that, GPL and NGPL allow it, but they have to give their sources back. So they have to help you improve at the same time. So I think copyleft works for business. I believe that fundamentally. The copyleft is a license for business development because it makes sure that the small company is on equal footing with the big company. Lots of people disagree with that. So yeah, like I said, I'm a biased guy. I'm not going to say, of course I'm going to say GPL. Did you have another question?
Yeah, another one if you don't mind. A little more complex one this time. So, as you know, in the Sandit team, we've had a number of occasions over the years that we've had to do some full enforcement or, you know, talking to companies. The most complex one we had, the key sticking point was in relation to the copyright registration system in the US. And that led to all sorts of problems. And in fact, it was one of the main reasons behind one of our development policies of personal copyright now within the Sandit project. How often does copyright registration or lack of copyright registration for free software projects play a role in enforcement actions?
Oh, you should... If you go to litigation, it's huge. You should go and read, if you really want some boring stuff that they're reading on this topic, the various motions that Best Buy has filed in the Conservancy versus Best Buy lawsuit. They are all over this question of, did BusyBox register its copyrights, and is the copyright it registered the one they're actually infringing and all that? And the reason they're so obsessed with this is because in the US, the damages you can get, and I think you know this, the statutory damages, which are damages it's called statutory because it's laid out in the law, and says you can get a certain number of thousands of dollars per infringement. Well, if per infringement means per device, which if you sell thousands of DVD players, that's a couple thousand dollars for every DVD player. The only other option other than statutory damage is actual damages plus profits. Now, electronics companies love to have a creative accounting that shows every product they make takes a loss, which how would they stay in business, I wonder, but they have creative accounting. That's the profit, so they can throw away the profits with creative accounting. Then you face actual damages. Well, what's the actual damage to you as a software developer if somebody proprietarizes the software? It's hard to show you have any, right? You have to show that, well, I didn't get a job because you did that. That's hard to show. So we usually chase the statutory damages. And here's where it relates to registration. Your copyright must be registered to chase the statutory damages. And I would hope that, I mean, this is one of the things I want to go around, so we can access talk, I go around and talk to. Samba should be actively registering its copyright on a regular basis. And by the way, I happen to run the Software Freedom Conservancy where Samba lives, and we are happy to help you get your registrations done. So I think every version, every GPL project, every version should go to the US and register some of the key copyrights in that version. You know, whoever's made it, take the video, right? Find who's moving around the most and register that person's copyrights when you release a new version. And you only have 4 years to register, too. That's another thing, is that you're supposed to register within 4 years of publication date. And that's important as well. Yeah, it's an issue, and it doesn't come up. The day-to-day enforcement, like most enforcement, doesn't go to litigation. It doesn't come up there. But when you get to litigation, those lawyers, they focus. When did you register? How did you register? Who registered? Are you going to, you know, Best Buy's throwing the book at us on that. And we're arguing. We're right, of course. So we're arguing back on everything. But it is an argument that has to be had in front of the judge. So it's important. Do we have time for one more, or are we out?
One more is okay.
One more question. Who wants to have their question answered? You said time for one more, nobody asked. So. Okay. Well, we'll call our close then.
Thank you, Bradley.
Thank you. Thank you all for inviting me. I really appreciate it. It's wonderful.
Now we're back on time. Thank you, Bradley.